I have to laugh. These talks just keep changing themselves. Sometimes I think, you know, I bring all this and then I should just throw the papers on the ground and pick them all up and present them that way because they keep changing. Anyway, I promised to speak to you on a topic called the lion's gaze, and I will, but when I was preparing it, it went off in a really interesting direction. So I followed it there, and here we are. So this is called the lion's gaze. So the phrase, the lion's gaze, comes from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. There's a book by a couple of my several Tibetan teachers, Kenshin Paulden and Kempo Sewan, called The Lion's Gaze, in which they say, a ripened, continuous insight gives us the steadiness and courage of a lion's gaze. Padmasambhava said that when a stick is thrown to a lion, the lion gazes steadily at the source, the thrower. A dog's gaze follows the object, the stick. Similarly, our source of experience is our own mind. The stick is only the phenomena. We need to look at our mind. It is the mind that projects. A wise and clear mind experiences something far more luminous and transparent. So that's some paragraph. A ripened, continuous insight gives us the steadiness and courage of a lion's gaze. A ripened, continuous insight. Wow, what's that? Can you imagine? So tonight I'm going to have us imagine a little bit what things like that might be like, and to understand that what we're being taught in all the traditions of Buddhism, what we're being shown by our practices, is that generally speaking, 99 and 99/100% of the time, we perceive the world with mistaken perception. The way we perceive is not the way things are. We have the kind of perception based on just the way this is put together. Five senses, and then the sixth, which is all the mental formations. The way this whole thing is put together and the force of karma results in a perception of duality, that there is an I and there is other. That perception from which our entire world, our stories, our lives, our thinking, all of it. That's what everything comes from, and that perception is a mistake. It's completely and entirely incorrect. Imagine what that means. Really, the whole thing is a mistake. You can see why the path is long and a bit difficult. Because we have to engage in untraining, unhabituating taking it all apart, piece by piece, which is what our practices are designed to do. Thank heaven. And they do it well. If we engage in the practices, they will do it well. But it's a big edifice. So taking it apart, sort of brick by brick and moment by moment, takes some time. It takes some practice, it takes some time. But what I'd like to do, if I can, tonight, is to help us see a little bit how that happens and what we're working toward. We're working toward the lion's gaze. We have the dog's view of things. So I'd like to give you just some really concrete examples from our practice of how this happens, how this works, so that you can see it. So, for example, we take what I call, and the teachings call, mindfulness of hearing. When we begin, we have mindfulness of hearing sensation. So that's what's happening. There is an experiencer, an awareness, experiencing a sensation, hearing sensation. But then the mind, the way we create that reality is we immediately call things sounds. And then the mind names the sounds. And at home, when you're meditating quietly in a quiet house, the mind can get a little freaked out if it can't identify a sound, you know? You get that little sense of panic. What's that? What's that? What's that? And when we find a name, then we feel better. Oh, okay, that's that. So it has constructed a world out there that's making sounds that we name from the experience of hearing sensation. We call that thinking. We're quite proud of it, actually. So you can distinguish that in your practice. We're learning to unravel that, to take our thinking mind out of that and then to let go of the thinking mind. So, for example, hearing sensation. Oh, that's a siren. That's a ticking clock. That's the dog next door barking. That's the refrigerator going on and off. All of that is thinking and naming sounds. With your practice, see the mind doing that and then allow yourself to drop all those thoughts, all that story, and notice what's left. What's left is hearing sensation. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. Worse yet, when we do that sort of thing, sometimes we get the self in there right away. That's my refrigerator. That's my refrigerator going on and off. That's my new refrigerator. That's my old refrigerator. I wish I had enough money to get a new one. So there's this story that starts to unfold about me in relation to hearing sensation, pleasant or unpleasant. How did I get in there? Who am I anyway, this owner of refrigerator, this wisher of new refrigerator? So there's a reaction that happened there. It was the hearing sensation, perhaps unpleasant. Then the story begins. Wish I could get a new refrigerator. I wish I could afford a new refrigerator. So from the unpleasant hearing sensation, the story, the sound is identified as refrigerator. The aversion to the unpleasantness has generated a reactivity. The reaction is the story about my refrigerator is too old. I wish I could get a new one. I don't make enough money. I wish I could make enough money. How come I can't make enough money? I'm just not good at anything. My whole life is a disaster. Da 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 da, crash, burn. And it's all hearing sensation. pleasant, unpleasant. That's all that's happening. And then reaction to the unpleasantness, story unfolds. Naming of sound, story about me, my life, I don't have enough money, da-da-da-da, spiraling downward. Train yourself to let go of the story. That's what we're doing in our mindfulness practice technique. Training ourselves to let go of the story. Just keep doing it. Show up, though. What's present? Awareness. Awareness is present. Awareness without a story. Vivid awareness without a story. Keep practicing that, and we string those moments together. Awareness without a story. Till we arrive someday, somehow, sometime, at a ripened, continuous insight. We do this, we can do this with seeing as well. It just happens. Our minds are habituated to identifying names for what is seen, objects of the sensation of seeing. I see a wall, I see a window, I see people, I see a tree. What about seeing itself, mindfulness of seeing, letting go of the naming of the objects, and certainly the story about the objects, the judging of the objects. Nice tree, bad color of wall, need new curtains, linoleum is hard, da-da-da, story, judging gets in there, reacting to pleasant or unpleasant. Without all of that, it's seeing. Sensation of seeing, pleasant, unpleasant, that's it. So again, with our practice, we can do this in the walking meditation where the eyes are open. Allow yourself to be mindful of seeing sensation itself. When the mind starts naming objects, allow yourself to be vividly aware of the mind doing that, looking at stuff in the world, reacting to stuff in the world. Let that go. Come back to mindfulness of pure seeing itself, pleasant or unpleasant. Seeing, mindfulness of seeing is different than looking at stuff. So allow yourself to train yourself away from the habitually conditioned naming of the objects, the looking at stuff, and bringing up mindfulness of seeing itself. Hearing, tasting, smelling. And all the judging ideas, the ideas of duality. That's a good tree, pretty tree, nice tree, bad weed, bad bush, non-native. Good, bad, right, wrong. The duality comes in there, the judging comes in there with the identifying of objects, the reacting, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, good, unpleasant, bad. So allow yourself to see that clearly as it's happening and then move your attention away from it, but keep the awareness there, just thinking, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant thought, unpleasant thought. Rumi said, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. You can imagine this. Where do you want to meet, Rumi? Where should I see you? There's this field. I'll meet you there. Doesn't even want to be anywhere where the duality dance is going on. Where is the field? What is the field? It's the field of awareness itself. Beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. Field of awareness itself. the field in which the ripened continuous insight is active, non-personal, non-individual, non-dual. There is awareness itself. Still in this body, there's seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and mental formations. And they all occur in the field of awareness itself. But immediately they fall into naming of objects, liking the pleasant, disliking the unpleasant, reacting to liking and wanting and needing and holding and grasping, disliking, pushing away, hating, rejecting. All of that story, the duality dance. And worse, it's all about me. I like it. I don't like it. I feel like this. I feel like that. This is what I think. This is how I feel. This is what I did today. This is who I like. This is who I don't like. The story of me endlessly rolling out of here, falling into the duality dance. With a perspective of the lion's gaze, with an understanding of that possibility, we can do what I often quote, that lyric written by a Western nun at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Turn the light around, shine it on the mind ground. Another way of saying this lion's gaze. Instead of, we're so engaged with all the objects, the phenomena, chasing after this and that, thinking about this and that, creating this outer reality, which is the misperception, the mind-created misperception. Instead, adopting the lion's gaze, we want to see where all of that stuff comes from. So we turn the light around. We shine it on the mind ground. We do this in our practice technique, just as I've described to you. Do it as much as you can. Because you're retraining this incredible energy, this potentiality, this awareness itself. You're retraining it out of the mistaken habit and into the possibility of meeting Rumi in his field, that field of awareness itself. And perceiving more and more in that way changes everything. It changes everything. We do have to, of course, also deal with this constant selfing, this self-referencing. It's so difficult to get out of that. It grabs onto everything. It even grabs onto this amazing practice and group of practice that techniques that we have, and it becomes my practice. And then we become possessive of that, and my sitting, my realization, my lack of realization, the story of how I don't succeed. The story of how I succeed. These endless stories generating. I did look up, I think I mentioned this last week, the exact words of that wonderful poem by David Ignatow. I should be content to look at a mountain for what it is and not as a comment on my life. I love that little poem because it really just shows us that illustrates the habit of seeing everything in relation to a me. Remember that little poem? As I was walking down the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Dear God, I wish he'd go away. We're always referring to something that doesn't exist. It's very bizarre, but if you construct the world from the point of view of something that doesn't exist, whoa, really, really, really mistaken perception. And yet that's what we're dealing with. So it's hard, and we're trying to transition out of that little by little, moment by moment, practice session by practice session, while also juggling this apparent world and all of its needs and all of the people in it who are sincerely suffering and our sincere desire to offer help and so forth. So it's a big thing we're doing. This is no small thing. No small thing engaging in this path. It's a profound journey. I love this lovely verse. I used to think Joker Beck wrote it, but actually it was written by a student of hers, Alan Kaprow. She formulated these four practice principles in her Zen tradition. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering. Holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment as it is, life's only teacher, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. There are so many things you can say about that. That's actually a rewriting of the Four Noble Truths. Beautiful way of saying it, though, because it's so practice-oriented, to see that we're caught in the self-centered dream. And as long as we are caught in that story, the story about me, this is who I am, this is what I think, this is what I did today, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, this is who I am, this is what I think, this is what happened to me today. As long as we're caught in that endless unfolding of the story of me, there will only be suffering. And what is the suffering? It's holding to the self-centered thoughts. It's believing them. It's the grasping and the clinging to these thoughts. This is who I am. This is what I think. This is my opinion. This is what I believe. Grasping at those self-centered thoughts is exactly the dream. The self-centered dream. The story. The plot. The narrative. It's as though there's a fiction character named Jude. And every thought I have is some part of the narrative. But it's a novel, it's a fiction. And yet, keeps unfolding, keeps unfolding, keeps unfolding. It's a habit. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. So, there we are turning the light around now, looking at this experience as it is. The only teacher we have. It's kind of handy that our teacher is here with us, life as it is. We go looking so far for the teacher, right here, right now, each moment, life as it is. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Compassion's way, telling us, really, take this seriously, that our practice itself, learning how to be just this moment, is the doorway, the opening to compassion itself. You know, I'm sure you all know, many of you know, the Anapanasati Sutra, the scripture on the full awareness of breathing. So there are a wide variety of techniques. Even in the Theravada tradition, we have Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. We have so many different. But the Anapanasati Sutra is a scripture that tells you that, you know what, if you don't want to do anything else. Practice full awareness of breathing, and you can walk the entire path through that practice alone. Being just this moment, you can use the breath as your root for that, and follow the whole path being just this moment, and you will find true, deep, immeasurable compassion, as well as deep wisdom and insight. If we keep getting caught in the story, the dream, we keep creating the suffering. So we have to train this mind out of the habit of identifying with the story, creating the story. We do this again so beautifully, so perfectly with our basic mindfulness technique. We sit, we use an anchor. Many, for most of us, maybe it's the breath sensation, the rising and falling sensations, sensations, any sensations of body, sitting, touching sensations, all occurring in the present moment. You can't have a sensation 5 minutes ago. You can remember one. You will be remembering in the present moment about a sensation 5 minutes ago, but the sensations only occur in the present moment. So already focusing mindfulness on any sensation occurring in present moment is a deep training, pulling the mind out of its habit of futuring and pasting and endlessly thinking about everything, and bringing it into the present moment experience, awareness of the present moment. And then, of course, inevitably, it always happens. We don't see it happening, but there's this moment we wake up and realize that the mind has wandered off into a story. We are completely disconnected from the breath sensations, the body sensations. We are always tempted in that moment to judge ourselves. I'm bad, 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 bad. My mind got distracted. I lost the breath sensations. I can't concentrate. I'm hopeless. So for a couple of reasons, I would urge you, beg you, plead with you to leave that whole judging story aside. Just dump it. Recycle it if you must somewhere. Compost. But because of two reasons. Number one, that moment that you woke up was a moment to celebrate. Mindfulness returned. So then the judging mind comes in and kind of wastes what could be a little celebration. You know, how about Yahoo, mindful again. Hooray, hooray. That would be better. That would be better. And then the second thing is that that whole thing reinforces the story of me yet again. Now I'm a bad meditator. I can't concentrate. My mind keeps wandering. Oh, big deal. Everyone's mind keeps wandering. It's not you alone. Believe me. Believe me. Everybody's mind is always wandering off. That's what minds do. You know, stomachs digest, lungs breathe, brains wander. It's just the way it is. So then that moment of awareness comes. Ah, hooray. Mindfulness has returned. Okay, great. Then the next thing, taking a quick glimpse. You have this moment or two before it might suck you back in to see what the mind was actually doing. So that's a wonderful opportunity to see quite clearly the story-making habit. So you might see quickly, planning, daydreaming, worrying, judging, endlessly judging, comparing, fantasizing. Or you might get in that quick couple of moments a quick glimpse of the flavor, maybe the color of an emotion there, and liking or disliking, you might see that quickly. Then once again, there's such a temptation to think about it, try to figure it out, and maybe, you know. So you got to watch that, because you get sucked right back into the whole thinking story. It might be more highbrow. It might be more profound. It might be, well, I'm doing psychological reflection, so it's okay. Or I'm doing Dharma reflections, so that's all right, you know. But you got to watch that because the mind gets so quickly sucked back into the habit of thinking. But you want to take the opportunity. You don't just want to go back to the breath without those couple of moments of seeing clearly. In insight meditation, you can. There are other techniques, concentration techniques. A concentration technique, when you see the mind is wandering, you don't take any moment to look at what the mind's doing. You just go back to your object. It might be the breath, it might be something else. Mantras are like that. Mind gets distracted, you just go back to the mantra because those build concentration. And that's a good thing. It's fine to do those practices, but they don't lead to insight. So insight practice, you have to, when you wake up with mindfulness, realizing the mind has wandered, you just have to take a couple of moments, not even minutes. Don't go as far as a minute. A couple of seconds to see, get a glimpse. There's one book called Glimpse After Glimpse, and that's what we're doing. We're getting this glimpse of what the mind is doing. And then, after that quick glimpse, you could just generically say thinking, and that's fine. But after you practice a while, many of you realize that you start to see habits, so you can name them really quickly. Planning, worrying, judging, comparing. And then you begin after a while to also begin to see flavors in the mind. Liking, disliking. Or it might be quite obvious that there's a emotional coloring. Anger, joy, happiness, sorrow. But again, if it's not obvious in just a couple of moments, don't be tempted to try to figure it out because the mind is so sticky. You'll immediately get sucked back into some kind of story and it'll go on and on, and before you know it, it'll be a few minutes later and you'll be thinking about 3 years from now and the vacation you're taking to Maui. You have no idea, how did that happen? So you have to take these quick glimpses, glimpse after glimpse, and then that moment of letting go of thinking entirely, profound moment in our practice, really profound and powerful. Before you learned this kind of meditation, did you know you could let go of thinking? You could let go of it in mid-thought. Joseph always tells the story, Joseph Goldstein, of how, you know, as a philosophy student, he hadn't even realized till he had this training that you could observe thinking. And he was so excited and delighted, he would invite his friends over to watch him meditate. I just love that, because it is, when you first read it, it's such a surprise. But it's a profound moment to let go of thinking and yet be aware and move the attention back to something that can ground you in the present moment without thinking. The awareness, you just kind of hug those sensations, rising, falling, sensations of sitting, touching. They are non-thinking experiences occurring in the present moment that you can anchor your attention with. As you go along, you know, after the first decade or two of practice, it actually becomes possible to let go of thinking and just be vividly aware in awareness itself. You don't need necessarily to anchor your attention in a body sensation. But don't try to do that too soon. If you do, just be careful, because the mind is so tricky. And you can think that you're doing that, and actually it's another kind of distraction. So, see, I'm more of the long-haul approach. So I stay with everything about several years, maybe after I might be able to, but I get it strong, you know. I get the stage strong. And then move forward. So maybe a middle path between that and doing it too soon. Anyway, that moment, very profound, because also a huge percentage of the time when you're letting go of thinking in that moment, you're letting go of the narrative of I. Because I don't know about you, but pretty much all the distractions go on in here. I'm the star of the show. It's all about me, right? And that, so then when we see, thinking, you know, the judging is going on, it's either judging me or judging other people from this perspective. So to let go of that and move back with a vivid, strong, present moment awareness, not just going off into daydreaming, avoidance, repression, sleep, but vividly present, rising, falling, sitting, touching, not generating the narrative, the story of me that's been going on since beginningless time, or if you don't buy that, at least since this birth, this life. It's powerful. It's very, very powerful. You're creating the opportunity to perceive another reality that isn't based on the constant generation of duality, self and other, and all that that implies. Rumi's field, beyond wrongdoing and rightdoing, the concepts about wrongdoing and rightdoing. It's not really about the objects. That's the dog chasing the stick. It's the ideas, concepts about wrongdoing and rightdoing. That's what we want to go beyond, to Rumi's field. So we create, we practice something that's called a receptive awareness. Gil Fonsdale said this really beautifully. Resting in receptive awareness is an antidote to our efforts of building and defending a self. As this capacity develops and we begin to trust it, the assumption that there is someone who is aware falls away. Self-consciousness falls away. Sometimes this is called an experience of non-dualistic awareness. The distinctions between self and other, inside and outside, perceiver and perceived, disappear. There is no one who is aware. There is only awareness and experience happening within awareness. Part of what we learn to do in practice is to steady our attention, to develop a simple receptive awareness. We aren't necessarily abandoning the world of ideas or even the idea of self. Instead, we learn to hold our lives, our ideas, and ourselves lightly. We rest in a spacious and compassionate sphere of awareness that knows but is not attached. In this way, our response to life can arise from our direct experience rather than our abstract ideas and attachments. Isn't that nice? That's really nice. That's what we're doing. We're developing a receptive awareness, and we're moving little by little, session after session, year after year. We're moving where we hold our strongest sense of what's true, out of the narrative and into that receptive awareness itself. And that changes things. It changes things a lot. Some of the other schools of Buddhism other than the Theravada will use a variety of techniques to help make this sort of shift. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a practice called pure perception, or sometimes it's called sacred outlook. Having spent so many years with just rigorous Burmese style mindfulness practice, which I love, I think it's the, I don't know, Mercedes-Benz of practice. But anyway, that's me, my story. When I first tried to understand and read some of the books, the paragraphs about pure perception, sacred outlook, I thought, what the heck are they talking about? I couldn't, and you imagine that you focus your energy on seeing the whole world as a Buddha field, a perfect field, a Buddha realm, everything is filled with Buddhas, you see your teacher as Buddhas, you see everybody else as a Buddha, you know, or a Tara, something like that. And I thought, you know, I have a good imagination, so I can do it. I just didn't know why. I couldn't quite figure out, what is this about? But I stayed with it a little bit, and then I found this wonderful, on the way, began to understand and to see what it actually does. It's another way, another technique of changing the habit of perceiving reality in the dual way, the way that we are habitually conditioned to do it. So in that case, it's really helpful. It'll train the mind to see differently. But it's also, doesn't come natural to us as it does to the Tibetans. So I want to give you another way of seeing pure perception that's actually much closer to the kind of style of mindfulness practice that we do. This is a story that Surya Das, a Western Lama, told about his friend, late friend John Blofield. You know, he's a great Buddhist author, scholar, translator. So he lived a lot in China and Tibet in the 50s and the 60s. And then in the 70s, he married and lived in Bangkok with his wife. So he said, once when I visited him there, John told me how difficult it was for him to get acclimated to living in such a bustling, noisy city after decades of living in Himalayan monasteries and Chinese Taoist hermitages. He said he found particularly challenging practicing meditation 2 hours in the morning in his Bangkok apartment before leaving for his office. So his apartment had a lovely shrine full of sacred art and so forth, the Buddhas that he'd collected and tankas and things. Apparently it was a really beautiful room. But despite the beauty of his surroundings, John couldn't keep the discordant sounds of Bangkok morning traffic from coming through his window and interrupting his meditation. One day something clicked into place. It must have been a blessing from the traffic gods, combined with that of his own lineage of guides and gurus. Augmented, of course, by the good karma he'd accumulated, and so on. Whatever the reason, one morning, when he was in his shrine room meditating on Tara, he suddenly realized that all those honking horns, droning engines, and clunking gears didn't sound that much different from the blaring of Tibetan longhorns and the clash of huge brass monastery cymbals wafting through his old hermitage window. In India, he had found those sounds when he was in India enchanting. So he asked himself, why should that be different now? He realized, and he says that he experienced it as like waking from a dream, that it was simply a matter of how he was perceiving those sounds. As distracting noise or as a celestial Tibetan ritual choir. And that made the difference. he realized that that was what the practice of pure perception is all about. That's the whole thing. You practice seeing all forms as rainbow energy and all sounds as deities chanting mantras and the Buddha light in everyone. But when you've given that as a technique, it's very hard to know what that's going to do or why that's going to do it. But this story is so perfect because suddenly he saw it happen in his own experience, that what was creating the aversion, the disturbance for a long time, apparently, his judgment, his reaction, his suffering, the whole thing was the way he was perceiving the experience, which was hearing sensation, and for those years it was hearing sensation unpleasant. And then somehow his mind remembered those sounds in a Tibetan monastery and saw how similar the sounds actually were, the traffic noises, and reinterpret it as hearing sensation pleasant. And more, even better, he saw that. He saw that that's what all the practices of pure perception are about, to help us see that it's happening in here. It's not happening out there. Now that, I want to say a couple of things about that. It doesn't mean that we somehow transform to a Pollyanna view of everything sweet and nice and lovely, because that's not our path either. But rather that we understand that the way we perceive things can be reviewed and reconstructed, rearranged, seen through, seen clearly. There are phrases in the tradition read, seeing the way things actually are. It's basically deconstructing the whole system and seeing how it works. Understanding it clearly, what's giving rise to what, where are the reactions, where is the story being created? But that being said, particularly emphasized in the Mahayana traditions, but certainly also in the Theravada, there is the emphasis on compassion. Seeing that whether beings are seeing reality as it is or not, if they're suffering, we care about it. But the great beings, it's a little bit like when you're a parent and your child, a young child, is frightened of the dragon in the closet, the dragon under the bed. So we take that fear seriously. We have compassion, even though we know there is no dragon under the bed. But that knowing, at least if we're kind parents, doesn't generate rudeness. There's no dragons under the bed. Straighten up. Act like an adult, speaking to a four-year-old. But instead, the compassion comes for the suffering of the being. So there is a strong sense, too, of the reality of beings, not just the way perception is mistaken, the way it's clear, but also the reality and the experience of beings in this situation, and respecting that as well. I found this wonderful poem. Do you know Adrian Mitchell? He just died in 2008. He was a great socialist pacifist of the 20th century, a great poet, a great writer. He wrote this wonderful thing. Life is a walk across a field. And he made the comment, life is a walk across a field. This is the opposite of the Russian proverb, life is not a walk across the field, which is the last line of Boris Pasternak's poem Hamlet. Life is a walk across a field, sometimes a golden dream drift of polished petals and daisies bounding among the hummocks of moss, which guide an infant river, sometimes over squashed grass, sometimes under the spongy turf. But sometimes the tickling green surface breaks underfoot, and the mouth of the ground gapes, and the bog dragon swallows down your shins, your hips, your armpits, your chin, your... Life is a walk across a field. And should you find a milkmaid in one hollow with a jug of cider and breasts like summer, from behind the spectacular oak will steam the minotaur, half farmer and half bull, guffawing as his horns impale you both. Oh, yes. Life is a walk across a field of buttercups and landmines. Isn't that just wonderful? That is the best poem. So, oddly enough, I take that as quite a good expression of when reality, the reality of our walking of the path, the willingness to see clearly and to see sort of both sides of experience, to see both suffering and the end of suffering, to work with our practice to let go of the habits of mind that create the duality and the suffering, and yet also realize and enter fully with compassion into the lives of suffering, both of ourselves and of others, and to work with that together. In the Tibetan tradition, they call that working with the absolute and the relative, and not turning our back on the relative reality, but also progressing and moving in the direction of perceiving absolute reality so that our potential, our strength, our possibility to work in and with the suffering of beings can be more powerful, can be stronger, because the more we understand what's actually going on and the more we have glimpses and moments of realization, the more our capacity will be to help others to move in the world of suffering, even though it is relative and illusory, with effective compassion. So, what does it look like when one has arrived in the absolute? Or even not arriving, but just perceiving differently. Li Po wrote, "The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains." We feel that just empty space. Nobody leaves, but there's only a mountain left. There's no more of that tight selfing. Well, he also said, "You ask me why I make my home in the mountain forest, and I smile and am silent, and even my soul remains quiet. It lives in the other world which no one owns. The peach trees blossom, the water flows." So he's asked a question, and that's how he answers it. Or another way of living in another reality. I love this beautiful poem. It's called Altars in the Street by Denise Levertov. And she mentions the news article. On June 17, 1966, the New York Times reported that as a part of the Buddhist campaign of passive non-resistance, Vietnamese children were building altars in the streets of Saigon and Hue, effectively jamming traffic. Children began at green dawn nimbly to build top-heavy altars, overweighted with prayers, thronged each instant more densely with almost visible ancestors. Where tanks have cracked the roadway, the frail altars shake. Here a boy with red stumps for hands steadies a corner. Here one adjusts with his crutch the holy base. The vast silence of Buddha overtakes and overrules the oncoming roar of tragic life that fills alleys and avenues. It blocks the way of pedicabs, police, convoys. The hale and maimed together hurry to construct for the Buddha a dwelling at each intersection. Each altar made from whatever stone, sticks, dreams are at hand is a facet of one altar. By noon, the whole city, in all its corruption, all its shed blood the monsoon cannot wash away, has become a temple. Fragile, insolent, absolute. Dwelling in the other reality, children often dwell there. So I have to end now. I'm going to leave you with another one of these wonderful Adrian Mitchell poems. To me, it's a metta poem for certain. The title of the poem is William Blake Says, Everything That Lives Is Holy. So I'll tell you the quote from William Blake. Everything that lives is holy. Life delights in life. Can I see another's woe and not be in sorrow too? Can I see another's grief and not seek for kind relief? That's the portion of Blake. So Adrian Mitchell, William Blake says, everything that lives is holy. Long live the child, long live the mother and father, long live the people. Long live this wounded planet. Long live the good milk of the air. Long live the spawning rivers and the mothering oceans. Long live the juice of the grass and all the determined greenery of the globe. Long live the elephants and the seahorses, the hummingbirds and the gorillas, the dogs and cats and field mice, all the surviving animals of our innocent sisters and brothers. Long live the earth, deeper than all our thinking. We have done enough killing. Long live the man, long live the woman, who use both courage and compassion. Long live their children. Thank you.